it's a new year, and we're going back to the old year. Remember what we were going through a series that I had called Messy Church. That is, we were visiting the ancient church of Corinth, and just a reminder, as we get into it, we realized, you know what, sometimes we think, oh, the good old days. You know, the church in the good old days, then it was perfect, pristine, and then we open up the New Testament and we find Eugene Peterson says, these are not showroom churches. You know, when you go to a showroom, everything is just put perfectly in place. He says, these are living rooms. You know, you come into a person's place and they aren't really expecting you and it looks lived in, right? And he says, that's what the church is like. Bishop Desmond Tutu, I came across a quote from him recently. He was visiting a New York prison and he said to the inmates there, are you familiar with the picture of the Good Shepherd Jesus? You know, the one where he is wearing a beautiful robe with a perfectly scrubbed, gentle little lamb, you know, across his shoulder as he brings it home. And then he said, that picture is wrong. A lamb in that situation would not look good or smell good, and neither would Jesus. They would both be scratched and sweaty and have brambles in their hair. They would be exhausted and filthy. That is simply how it is when we are on our way home. The picture of the Christian life that we get when we read Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, and I invite you to turn to it. It's a genuine one, which means that the Corinthians smell like sheep. They are still works in progress, like we are, unfinished, incomplete, inexperienced. The great benefit, of course, is that this letter, though not written directly to us, allows us to overhear a fascinating conversation and relationship in process. I want to kind of get you back up to speed, showing a brief clip that I showed, something called the Bible Project. They're working at doing an overview of different books of the Bible, and one that they've done is 1 Corinthians, and I want to show a little bit of that to kind of give you a little bit of background and bring you up to speed. Oh, I should be clicking that.
Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, written to a church community that Paul knew really well. Corinth was a major port city in the ancient world and had lots of temples to Greek and Roman gods. It was a big economic center. And so Paul strategically came here as a missionary. He spent a year and a half there getting to know people, talking to them about Jesus. And a whole bunch of people became followers of Jesus and formed a church community. You can read about all of this in Acts chapter 18. So after a while, Paul moved on to start churches in other cities, and he started getting reports that things were not going well at all back at the church in Corinth. It was plagued by all kinds of problems, and that's why he wrote this letter. It's broken up into five main parts, along with a final greeting. And these five sections correspond to five main problems that Paul is addressing. And so the letter reads like a collection of short essays on different topics, but there are these core ideas that unite all of the pieces together. So here's what he does in each section. He describes the problem, but then he always responds to that problem with some part of the story of the gospel, which is the good news about Jesus. And he shows how they're actually not living out what they say they believe. And so this letter is all about learning to think about every area of life through the lens of the gospel.
So that's what we want to do. Is we're learning to look at every area of life through the lens of the gospel, of what God has done in Jesus, and how that is the paradigm that impacts our whole lives. And so we're going to focus in, this section of the letter gets into focusing on the area of relationships. Now, when it comes to relationships, some people have grown up in homes, including Christian homes, where sinful attitudes and destructive behavior were accepted as normal. We may be so used to being mistreated or disrespected or controlled or manipulated that it just seems, well, normal. Like a woman, call her Jackie, who asked her friend, I'll call her Leslie, how often her husband cursed her. Well, when her friend replied that he never did, Jackie didn't believe her. Why? Because all the men she knew, Christian or otherwise, regularly cursed at their wives and children when they got mad. Some of you have had similar experiences. On the other hand, some of you grew up on a steady diet of Hollywood or Harlequin romance versions of love and marriage that portrayed unrealistic, distorted ideas around love and marriage. They gave you the impression that if you just have enough sexual passion, the rest of the relationship is easy. And others may have grown up in stable, loving families, but your own marriage is nothing like that. You worry that your children won't have the same sense of security and love that you grew up with, but you don't know what to do or how to change it. In chapter 7 of Paul's letter to the Corinthians, we pick up on what has already been a rather provocative conversation. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is not good for a woman to have sexual relations with women. Now, in verse 1, Paul's referring to the matters about which you wrote. It is worth noting that Paul has already, in the first six chapters, been talking to them about matters that they did not include in their letter to him. They didn't bother to tell him, for example, about the major ethnic and theological disputes that were tearing their group apart. Nor did they give any hint that there was a case of incest in the congregation, nor the case of the members taking one another to court, both of which had made the local news in Corinth. They had chosen to include a question about sex in their written correspondence to Paul in this chapter 7, but they had framed the question, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, right? Clouding the fact, probably, that there were others in the congregation with very casual attitudes towards sex who were in the habit of going to public places and prostitutes to satisfy their sexual desires, as we read about in chapter 6. Well, Paul found out about these things anyway, and he made sure that he addressed those first. And now he's addressing the things that they did ask him about, like marriage and relationships. Now keep in mind, Paul is not writing a general treatise on marriage, but is responding to a specific set of issues and questions posed by the Corinthians in their letter. It's kind of like a case study, usually focuses on particular issues. I've tried to frame them as questions in the following outline, the outline that I've put for you. And you can see them on the outline. And we're going to take one at a time. So first, what about sex in marriage? Some Bibles will have, it's good to not touch a woman. That was a euphemism, okay? And that's what they really meant. Why would married people even consider a sexless marriage? You wonder about that? I mean, I wondered about that. Then or now? And then I thought, well, you know, I grew up in cattle country. And in cattle country, it was a long time before I ever came across a vegetarian. Somebody who doesn't eat meat. And it was like, wow. You know, we had a definition for vegetarian. The local people said, oh, vegetarian, that's the original word for lousy hunter. But, you know, there's a lot of vegetarians, right? And so it seems strange in that setting that anyone would be a vegetarian. Here, there's reasons behind it. But in chapter 6, Paul had addressed the kind of anything goes people who would practice casual sex with no limits. Here, in chapter 7, he is responding to the opposite extreme, the other end of the pendulum, ascetics, those people who have set all limits, who viewed the body and sex as evil, including sex, even in marriage. Now, there have been some equally negative views of sex in church history, and could go into that. They have been misguided views based in part upon people's interpretation of verse 1. That is Paul saying it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman? Or is Paul quoting the Corinthians? In the original language, in the Greek, there's no quotation marks. King James Version, no quotation marks. It looks like this is Paul's statement. Most modern interpreters put quotation marks to help us get, no, this is what the Corinthians have been saying, and Paul is correcting the attitudes and qualifying some of the things that they are saying. And so we'll read that. So now Paul is qualifying, but since sexual immorality is occurring, as we knew from the previous chapter, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent, and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. See, it makes most sense to read Paul as qualifying their statement in the verses that we just read. And that his concession is not, you know, well, marriage is second rate, or that sex is second rate to a sexless one. No, he's qualifying that if you do abstain for a time for devote yourself to prayer, I'll grant you that. But he isn't commending it as a regular habit. For Paul, in verse 7, Paul refers to his own marital status, which here is unmarried. And he says that's equally honorable and even preferable given his gift of God, that it would be celibacy and his vocational calling. He traveled thousands of miles all around the world. But for all the already married, their calling is clear. Maintain a healthy sexual relationship. It's worth noting how Paul's vision of healthy, Christ-like marital relations is actually groundbreaking against the background of the times. You see, Paul places an entirely new emphasis upon mutuality, reciprocity, and mutual agreement in marriage. This is one area of their life that has principles that are illustrative of the larger whole realm of marriage. This vision of a healthy marriage relationship posed a challenge to the prevailing patriarchal culture, which saw the husband as the master of the house, often central, superior, and deserving. In our world, it poses a challenge also to the false images of sex and marriage that surround us. A book I would strongly recommend, we have it in our library, by Timothy and Kathy Keller in their book, The Meaning of Marriage. They note how marriage used to be about us. Now it has become about me, the me marriage, as one writer has called it. Surely, slowly but surely, this newer understanding of the meaning of marriage has displaced the older ones in Western culture. As one young woman noted, I'm getting married next year because I love my fiancé. However, she also added in her post, if things change, I won't hesitate to divorce him. That's a me marriage. And Paul, dramatically, in what he's talking about, the sense of mutuality and equality, is definitely countering that. Well, what about widows and widowers? In verses 8 to 9, Paul addresses this crowd within the community, the unmarried and the widows, those who have lost a spouse to death. And, well, let's read that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot or do not control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Paul seems to put himself in this group, given that his recommendation to remain as they are also includes his personal example. Paul's counsel is accompanied, however, by an important qualifier, urging them to practice marriage, to seek remarriage, if not practicing self-control. Here again, the widespread problem of sexual immorality that was so prevalent in Corinth comes into play. Those who feel the compulsion of sexual desire should marry, he says, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, that doesn't sound like the best reason for marriage, does it? Now, I know it's realistic, reason for marriage. And Paul isn't saying this is the best and main reason for marriage. He's not giving a whole treatise here. He's responding to something specific, the reality. It's not saying this isn't the only and most important one. If you guess this one right, oh, your marriage will work great. No, he is saying this is a significant factor to play into your decision-making and into your discernment. In fact, on other occasions, here his emphasis is to the, it's better, I think, to stay unmarried. And he'll say a little bit more why later on in this chapter. But, in a different context, in the city of Ephesus and writing there, especially to younger widows, he says, my counsel for you is to get married. So we need to look at the whole biblical counsel. We'll look a little bit more about that. But it's important to look at the specific context that's being addressed. Well, what about divorce? You see, in verse 10, Paul affirms that marriage is for life. But in verse 11, he also acknowledges that marriages do break down. Surprise. Verses 10, to the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. That is, he can cite back, Jesus gave specific counsel on this. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Paul here assumes a situation in which reconciliation is still possible. He does not say explicitly what a person should do, though, when reconciliation is no longer possible. And so we wonder, Paul, are there any exceptions? Well, he doesn't refer to one, but we know that Jesus had an exception, right? He said, except for adultery in Matthew chapter 5, verse 32. Later on in the next section, Paul will talk about, well, what if in the situation where the spouse deserts or abandons you, no longer wants to be in relationship? And so we might look, there's another example. And some have wondered, well, what about the situation of abuse as well? You see, nourishing relationships have a beneficial impact even on our health. Toxic ones can be like a slow poison in our bodies. I've seen it. I've heard it. Our own conference has put out a brochure called When Marriages Fail. It's very helpful. If you want a copy, we can get some. It's also available online. Just a quote from there. In general, it should be said that when we seek guidance from Scripture on such questions as divorce and remarriage, we look in vain for detailed instructions for every possible eventuality. However, when it comes to the question of how the church should deal with marriages that have failed, we have to listen to the gospel as a whole. The good news of the gospel is that Jesus Christ came to deliver fallen humanity from sin, guilt, brokenness, and failure. Nowhere do Christ or his apostles suggest that divorce and remarriage are unforgivable sins, grievous as they may be. By his offer of forgiveness for sin, Christ made it possible for people who have failed to make a fresh start. And I will leave it at that and commend that to you. Because we need to move on. You don't want to be here all morning. Anybody want to? No, I don't think you want to be. Okay. What about people in a mixed marriage? That is, a believer and an unbeliever. You see, in these verses 12 to 16, Paul addresses a problem that rose out of the missionary activity of the church. As the good news about what Jesus had done, about what God had done in Jesus, was proclaimed and declared in Corinth, a husband might be converted, but not the wife, or vice versa. And the question was, well, can a believing spouse remain in the existing marriage relationship? We'll read Paul on that, verses 12 to 16. To the rest, I say this. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. That is, not holy, excluded. But as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or the sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? The reason for their doubt about whether they should stay in this relationship with a believer and an unbeliever is probably because they had, it seems to be, a negative paradigm in mind. And a negative paradigm would be something like contamination. Okay, remember with the SARS virus? You don't want any association with that, right? That's a negative paradigm. Another negative one would be a negative influence. And we have the proverb, one bad apple, right, spoils the lot. Okay, those are negative paradigms, negative influence. And from their Jewish background, about when something, you touch something unclean, you became unclean and you had to have ceremonial cleansing, that would be a natural paradigm that they would think of. But you see, Paul's answer is, can you stay together? Yes. Why? Because he goes on to use a positive paradigm and a paradigm of positive influence. And he would have just been going back to Jesus. When someone who was unclean came up and touched him, did Jesus become unclean? No, so often what we find is, just was reading this again this week, the leper, he comes and he touches the leper. And everyone in that culture would know, now you're unclean. And what happens instead? Jesus' cleanness and wholeness goes to the leper and the leper gets healed. There's a positive paradigm of influence. And think of Jesus be the salt of the earth, positive influence, leaven, light. And Paul's view of marriage here, he is saying, no, be a positive influence. He gives them a positive paradigm to think about this. Even marriage to an unbeliever, he says, is filled with potential and hope. However, if the unbeliever partner insists on leaving, the believing spouse is not bound to stay with the unbeliever. Is a deserted partner then free to remarry? Paul doesn't say. Interpreters differ. But it would appear that when an unbelieving partner divorces a believing spouse and then marries someone else, the Christian spouse is free to marry again. We could say more, but that's all we have time for. I wanted to go to the next section. One of the big guiding principles that Paul gives in verses 17 to 24, and we're going to go this. I would summarize it by taking those three yellow lines. Each person should live as a believer in the situation in which when the Lord called them. Notice he repeats that three times. It's an underlying principle that he is using in response to the questions that they are asking. Because they're saying, we've become Christians, now these different things in life, what should we be changing? What should be staying the same? What should be modified? And Paul's basic principle, as I would describe it, is basically he's saying, bloom where you're planted. Bloom where you're planted. Okay, and he gives three examples. He's already given the marital example of marital status. You know, were you married when you were called? Then don't try living as if you weren't married, okay? Like, that's God's calling for you, is to live Christianly in the marriage, in the relationship that you're in. And each of them he's going on. And then he will give other examples. He will talk about circumcision or one's ethnic identity. And then he will go on to social status. If you're a slave, you know, I'm supposed to be a slave to Christ. Does that mean I need to somehow get out of this relationship with the one who owns me right now? And Paul's like, to be a good Christian, you don't have to. If you have the opportunity, yeah, go for it. But you don't have to. Marriage, like ethnicity and social status, belongs to the category of adiaphora. There's a Greek word. Adiaphora, that is the indifferent. That is matters that fundamentally don't make a difference. On this basis, Paul articulates the very simple rule, don't try to change your position. When John the Baptist is preaching and people are coming to faith, they also, different occupations, and they ask him, what should we do? And he doesn't say the soldier, no, you shouldn't be a soldier anymore. He says, but you know the abuses in your line of work. Those should stop. Tax collectors, you know the abuses in your line of work. Those should stop. You should be a Christian tax collector. Now, there will be some in some parts of Scripture where it's, no, that kind of in line of work, you can no longer continue to do. So if there were any prostitutes in the Corinthian church, no, you can't be a Christian prostitute. Okay, would be the extreme example. So that's his main principle, though. As long as you can, bloom where you're planted. Well, in the final section of this letter, Paul responds to the question raised by the Corinthians of whether engaged people may go ahead and marry, or whether, having become Christians, they are obliged to remain unmarried, stay in the situation in which God called you. Well, Paul's answer to this question is completely consistent with the pattern that we have seen in other cases in this chapter. It is better, he says, to remain as you are, in this case, unmarried. But if you choose to marry, he says in verse 36, that's not a sin. It's right, even, he says. The conclusion of this section in verse 38 sums up Paul's position nicely. He says, he who marries his fiancée does well, and he who refrains from marriage does better. Well, perhaps even more important than the specific advice Paul gives in this particular context is the reasons. Why would he say it's even better to remain unmarried? Why should the unmarried remain unmarried? And Paul offers two reasons that are worth noting. First, he says in verse 26, this present crisis. And secondly, he says, so that they may live in undivided devotion to the Lord. He says that in verse 35. Now we might wonder, well, what crisis are you talking about? The simple answer, we don't know. Lots of ideas, but we don't know. But what we do know from verse 28 is that he's wanting to spare them from many troubles, he says. And I think back to Jesus, when Jesus is talking about a great time of crisis that is coming. In Matthew chapter 24, for example, in verses 19 to 20, he says, woe for nursing mothers and young children, families with young children in those days. And I think about some friends of mine, a former church secretary, who was a little girl living through World War II on a trek that took almost 2 years, living through winters in open areas, and how difficult it was for her mother when her husband died along the way. And so that may be what Paul has in mind, some famine, some could be conflict that is coming. He believes, obviously, that the thing that that they will better be prepared to face these trials if they are single rather than married. So it's very context-specific advice. And he also believes that the things of this world are only relatively significant or insignificant in the light of eternity. So is marriage a lesser good? You know, does it just divide our interests? Well, given the present context and conditions, Paul says the time is short, that is limited time and energy to finish the Lord's work. His answer clearly tilts to yes. Yes, marriage in this context may be a lesser good. But given a different context, as I mentioned in Ephesus, where he writes his first letter, 1 Timothy chapter 5, and given different conditions, and he also says depending on your gift, that is, do you have the gift of celibacy or not? Or is ministry to the Lord better accomplished as a married person? Then he gives different counsel, but the underlying principle at work is both. Basically, consider God's calling in your own life, your context, and your commitments, and then pursue what seems best, the best way to serve the Lord. I remember years ago, 1990, Elaine and I were married, no kids yet, Wow, what a freedom time at that time. And, you know, we got a call from a call. I was working construction at the time, but wanted to go into pastoral ministry. God had put that call on my life, and it was just a time matter of when. And I got a call from a pastor in New Brunswick. I'd been on a missions trip there a couple years ago, and a couple years before that, and he said, I want you to come pastor the church where I'm at for 3 months. I have a sabbatical in Vancouver, and I was wondering if you'd be interested in swapping places. Well, we talked about that, and sure enough, we did that. We had opportunity. We were able to just pack up and to go for the summer. I know I had to be apart for about 5 weeks while Elaine was finishing her school, teaching school. That was difficult. But then, 5 years later, we were again a ministry transition. I had been pastoring, was in between positions. 1995, got a call again. I'm from the same pastor. I'm retiring. I think you should come and pastor this church. Now we had 2 kids and a third, and she was pregnant with a third one. No family supports. And as we were praying and thinking about this, this chapter came very much to mind. And some people thought we were wrong, but I discerned, no, Dave, the context in which you are now in, you need to give priority to your wife and to your kids. And is that a context in which they can thrive or in which they might die with no family around? And we had seen it. I had met somebody who had wilted under that kind of situation. And I sensed, no, it was a different context in that time than now. May have been right, may have been wrong, but that was what I really believed the Lord was calling me to and calling us to at that time. So I want to get to just quickly a few takeaways. I think this chapter gives us a model of discernment. In previous chapters, Paul had some things that were just very clear, black and white, right and wrong. Here he's getting into things that, well, what's better or best? Not good and bad, but good, better, or best. And how do we discern that? And he keeps inviting them to participate in that task of moral discernment. Also, a model of Christian marriage. We could have spent a lot more time, but mutual fulfillment through mutual sacrifice. That's the model that Paul presents. Also about divorce and remarriage. Paul gives a general rule. Now we can just, some just take the general rule, no divorce. But you look further and then there's particular cases where there's other principles that come into play. And we see it in Jesus, we see it in Paul. And I think, I don't have more time to go into that, but just to say some takeaways. I think it's important to have general rules, but also to immerse oneself in particular cases, prayerfully, thoughtfully, with wise and discerning Christians as well. And one of the things very clear in here is the value and dignity of singleness. And especially in Paul's background, I don't know if I had the quote. I had a quote from, I can't remember, came across from one of the rabbis. It was just basically like, if you're not married by 20, like, when are you going to grow up? Okay? And you think, oh, that's his context. And so this was radical, saying God values, and you think about it, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, God is blessing marriage. He instituted it. And then when the new Adam comes along, that is Jesus in the New Testament, he's single. He is, and it's like God is saying, there are more than one way to live fully for me. Okay? And he honors, values that. And the power of influence, and I would say especially the power of positive influence, the vision, the positive paradigm that I talked about that he presents, and also challenges us to reframe and revalue everything in the light of God's priorities. Everything, whether it's the job that we're going at. Well, are you thinking about the bottom line for me, or are you thinking about God? And I remember a mentor challenging me, not just Dave, I hear you talking about what you want to do with your life. What if you ask God what he wants to do with your life? That was just like a totally different paradigm. I should have known it, but it was just like, that was what God used to put me on the track and to rethink, no, yeah, God might be calling me to pastoral ministry. And God might be calling you to a different line of using your gifts and abilities. I commend this to you. Let's pray. Lord, we have gone through a lot of immersed ourselves in the church in Corinth this morning. And yet, Lord, as we have listened to the conversation taking place, there are some things we are still maybe left scratching our heads, not knowing exactly what he meant. And there's other nuggets, Lord, that we discover that challenge us to be very mutual, mutually sacrificial in our closest relationships, that challenge us to put your priorities uppermost when we are making any decision in life, especially the significant decisions of our life. about whether we will marry or who, where we will live, what we will do, and how we can best serve you. Lord, I pray that we would take those nuggets that you have spoken to our hearts this morning and that they would get worked into the fabric of our lives, whether that be at home or in the marketplace or in the neighborhood. Amen.